You know, do whatever you want to do. I don't care. Your rules are full of shit.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 285 for the week of January 13th, 2020. I am American Ninja Motion Picture Series David T. Cole, and I'm here with basketball team Sarah D. Bunting.
Dribble, dribble.
High Fiver Tara Ariano.
Up top.
And 5 second rule Meredith Smith.
Eat me.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. This week we are going to be talking about Freeform's remake of Party of Five and the changes that they made therein. And when we decided that this was going to be our topic, obviously we had to look back not too far into the archives of this very podcast, all the way back to episode 279, our last all-canon episode, when we had a presentation about the original Party of Five from one Meredith Smith and thought, we have to get that woman back to talk about the new show. And we did, and she's here. Please welcome Meredith Smith. Hello, Meredith.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. Yes. Thank you. I feel like Courtney Cox being pulled out of the crowd by Bruce Springsteen.
And we should say a greater sacrifice. Happy birthday today as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yay. Yay to aging.
So that's the end of the happy part of this segment. Now we're going to get into stuff that's terrible and sad. Oh, man, this show. So Party of Five, we all recall and discussed, as I said, back in 279, is the story of five children orphaned by the death by drunk driver of their parents. However, in the new show, they are effectively orphaned when their still living parents are deported. Thanks to horrible, violent immigration policies in this country. So that's what happens in the pilot. There's a raid on the restaurant, and even though the Acostas have been here peacefully for 18 years and raised their children and started a business, they are summarily deported. Hiring the best immigration lawyer in Los Angeles does nothing except put them even further in debt, the kids, that is. There's a couple of interesting touches in the two episodes aired back to back for the premiere. Beto, who is the Bailey character, we find out early on is failing Spanish because his parents didn't speak it much at home, despite it being their first language. The oldest kid, Emilio, who is the Charlie figure, has signed up with DACA, which means he has status now, but that could change. We don't know. And I could not even get through making my notes for this podcast episode today without crying again, remembering it. So I will try to keep it together. We'll see how it goes. So let's start here. I give Freeform a lot of credit for being in the vanguard of depicting current U.S. immigration policy accurately, which is to say, as state violence. They featured multiple undocumented characters on The Fosters, for example. And listeners of this podcast know I'm a big proponent of positive propaganda, so I definitely approve of radicalizing tweens and teens through scripted drama. But even knowing what this show is about, I was not prepared to be as shattered by it as I was. Meredith, what were your thoughts on these first two episodes?
All the crying, all the time. It was brutal. When they say goodbye at the detention center, I mean...
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Oh, my God. And, you know, I was excited for a reboot because I'm really in the tank for Party of Five. And I think that this is would be easy for a reboot. But what they chose, this narrative hook about the parents being deported, it just wrenches your heart out. It really does. So I watched this with a box of Kleenex. And... Mm-hmm. And occasionally, like, they'll give you those heartwarming moments. And sometimes on Freeform, those moments can feel a little cheesy. But on this show, it felt like relief.
Yeah.
Like, oh, thank God the kids are connecting because this is awful and everything's on fire. So they deserve this heartwarming moment in the backyard.
Yeah. Sarah, what were your thoughts as someone who I know watched at least a bit of the original series?
First of all, I have some questions for the group about whether we think that some of it is effective because of the subject and not necessarily the construction of this specific narrative. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. whatever it is, weeping, like tears meeting under my chin and dripping down to an Iron Giant level.
Yeah.
Just the shot of them moving along the fence. Oh, God. But there's also for olds like us who watched the original, there is a lot of blocking decisions and direction of the actors who are all pretty good, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That
agreed.
Especially Nico Guardado, who plays Beto, who like his fuck out of here face is some of the best shit on TV, but they're reminiscent of their analogs in the original. Lucia has many Neve Campbell-y tics, and I don't know if she's just like that and that's why she was cast, or if she was told to make these sort of like hesitant, sideways, impatient movements to reflect Neve Campbell forward. Val has some Lacey Chabert Ian acting, like blocking and tics, and that's interesting to me. It was like just enough of that to make me wonder whether they were cast on those bases or whether they were directed to put in those elements. But I also liked that there are a couple of scenes where you're conditioned from years of the WB to think that whatever teacher or authority figure is going to be like, melt and be like, fine.
Yes.
But like there's one exchange with the teacher where she's just like, well, some of us work to be here and understand there's consequences, and like slams the door in the kid's face, and you're like, well, that's realistic. But yes, the heartwarming moments definitely are earned for the viewer because you just need a rest from everything being terrible. My last comment for right now is that the way that they depict the increasing chaos around like the baby and the dishes piling up made my middle-aged ass so anxious that that really worked. I assumed that I would watch these and be reasonably compelled but not decide to keep going with the series, but I think I'm gonna keep watching it. I thought this was really well done and like positive propaganda for sure, and I'm into it. So
yeah, I agree with you that I did feel pandered to as someone who watched it in the 90s. Yeah. And I picked up on those touches on Lucia too. There's especially in her wardrobe, like it seems like they've dressed her.
Yes, the sweater and the overalls.
Yes. And the weird, like she's in the second episode, she's in like a not quite a crop top, but a short t-shirt with like a lettuce frilly, sleeves and bottom and like a drawstring. Like, Yeah. And in her first scene after the parents are detained, she's in the kitchen in this like XXXXXXL sweater under overalls. It's like,
oh no,
this is not how the teens are dressing in 2020. Like, I watch Teen Mom, I know. But I felt like that was a nod for those of us. So yeah, Meredith, as a canon submitter, did you feel pandered to pleasantly, or did you find that it chafed?
Well, I thought that one of the first things I clocked to was that they were calling Beto Bay, which, I called Bailey Bay as if we were like good friends or something. So that was a nice echo.
Yeah.
I did, in the pilot, sometimes I did feel like the echoes were a little too strong. Like I wanted to see them kind of make their own beats. And I especially felt that with Lucia, because I felt like her Julia rebelling angry thing happened a little too fast in that first episode. With the second episode, that really started to breathe. And so that I think gave some balance to, we're trying to, remind you all of what you used to love, but here's like, it's also a new thing. I felt like it settled down in that second episode. And so I was like, I am pleasantly reminded of what came before. And now look forward to Lucia getting pregnant, because that was the season two storyline on the original.
Yeah. We'll see if they pull the punch the way they did in the original show, too.
It's not on Fox. Seriously. Maybe there's hope.
Right. Dave, you were not a watcher of the original series. What were your high level thoughts on these first two episodes?
You know, having the parents be deported instead of killed actually makes things much worse, because at least when your parents mm-hmm. are no longer in the picture, you know what the score is. Yeah. You know, as far as your responsibilities go, as far as what you need to do to survive. But having them deported and it being at the beginning of that process, by the end of the first episode, they are deported, but there is a chunk of time, it seems to be about 2 months or so, maybe a little bit longer, where they are, I don't even know what it is, you know, basically they're in camp.
They're
in
detention.
Yeah.
ICE. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Makes it so much worse. You know, it's like when you age out and you have kids and you end up taking care of your kids and your parents. You know, it's almost that situation, except it wasn't something you asked for. It wasn't something you got yourself into. It wasn't just happenstance of time moving forward. And then when that falls apart and suddenly the foundation of your family is no longer there, but the rest of the family must move on. And they're all kids. You know, the oldest one is supposed to be what in this show? Like early 20s?
24.
Yeah. Yeah. Like not good. And
yeah,
it made it that much more anxious to watch, you know, because they have to deal with everything to do with not only themselves, but now there's like a family business that is in danger of falling apart. And that is where any stability in this whole picture is stemming from, and that is in danger. Never mind trying to get the parents back into the States, trying to figure out, you know, what they could do while they're there and what happens after they're sent back to Mexico. And it's just like, oh, it's just like they managed to make a terrible situation figure out a way to make it worse. And you know, welcome to 2020. Yay.
Yeah.
That really nailed that home was the scene in the camp where, you know, they combined the train to nowhere with, you know, the kind of this concentration camp imagery of them, the family just moving along the fence, trying to each say their last goodbyes. Mm-hmm. And that isn't really like, you know, this is a show that is fiction, but not really, you know, that is like, yeah. Mm-hmm. it does sort of punch you in the gut. I am curious moving forward how they're actually going to make this a show that is still good, but makes you want to still tune in, because it is like kind of a lot right now. And there's a few moments of levity. Like,
are you the weed guy? I enjoyed that.
Yeah. this does have its roots in a teen drama. And how is that going to be balanced with all the capital I important things they're going to say and keep it entertaining enough that it will be able to survive on TV? It'll be a balancing act.
Yeah, without trying to stretch the story in ways that are not realistic or credible or that line up with you know, the current state of things. So the one thing that I thought they established that was that might pay off later was Vanessa, who gets hired as the new hostess. They say that like her parents have been taking care of her whole life, and she's now a graduate student in psychology. And, you know, maybe there's going to be something later on where she is like the deus ex machina money wise, where she has resources that they need, you know, in terms of connections or just having money, because she comes from a wealthier family. But in terms of Lucia, the Julia character, I did think it was interesting in that scene at the detention center where they're telling the parents it's time to go, and she yells at the ICE agent in a way that
her
parents
tar it out is what my notes said.
Yeah, well, yeah, and but because it establishes something that's interesting with her is that it's like she's caught between these two worlds. Like, she's having this racist policy enacted on her, but at the same time, like, she is an American citizen, so she does have certain kinds of privilege, you know, still. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of figure out what to do with her character and what other ways she might bring those to bear in the future, because it does seem like they're doing a good job having her, you know, consider her position and broaden out the empathy that she has in other directions, like with the runaway kid at the shelter. I like that. Now they handled that too, in terms of, you know, not all families are separated by the government. Sometimes they separate by choice and it's better off, and we have empathy for those situations too.
Yeah, it seems like she's got she's the vehicle for that, when it seems like some of the other kids, they're focused more internally on can they even make it. In fact, I think that's a big question with this reboot, is a question of can the family even survive,
right?
Which you didn't see in the original show. We were 6 months out from the death of the parents. The restaurant was a lot more stable. They lived in a house that made the full house, you know, San Francisco mansion, looks small. So, you know, I feel like a level of fear, and I feel like Julia or the Lucia, gosh, I want to call them the old character's name still. But she's the character that really seems to be reflecting a lot of the political machinations that are going on.
Yeah. I feel like we've already said that we at least want to try to keep watching it, even though it is so sad. But we should make sure that we impress upon our listeners, it's so sad. It's so sad. I was not prepared for how sad it is, truly.
This is definitely, if they can find that Everwood balance of,
oh yeah,
like, damn you Berlanti emotion, where at like minute 40, you're just like, but also feel some measure of hope, even a small one. Otherwise, it could just be too bleak to continue. But I think that, at least in the pilot, like, they had to not sugarcoat anything. And if they can get that balance going forward, then, I mean, I'd still miss Everwood. And still, like, people like Chris Pratt, I'm like, right, Bright from Everwood.
Bright Abbott, yay!
That's not what he's famous for, but it is in my heart. So yeah, it's just a matter of figuring out how to be real about what's happening to these characters, but not have it such a dark blue that nobody can stand to watch it. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is time to go around the dial talking about a little something to watch on TV these days. First up, Tara Ariano.
Well, speaking of shows we can't stand to watch.
Oh,
this week, there was a sneak preview for a new hour-long show on NBC called Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Whoa.
Yes.
Wow.
It's an hour.
Wow, Godspeed.
So here's the situation. Jane Levy, who used to be on Suburgatory and was also on at least season one of Castle Rock, is Zoe. She had her father, who's played by Peter Gallagher, has some kind of like super rare neurological disease. So that's been like gradually shutting down all of his systems. So she's been having some headaches and stuff and is worried. And so she goes to get an MRI to make sure it's not whatever he has. And while she's there, the tech offers to put on a music playlist, and that first track is It's the End of the World as We Know It, should warn us of what's to come. But then what happens is there's an earthquake before they really get started that scrambles the playlist or something. And when she comes back out, she can hear everyone's inner monologues. And it turns out everyone's inner monologue in San Francisco is extremely on-the-nose song choices. To wit, a lonely woman sings All by Myself, a bunch of horny women leer at a passing hunk with What a Man, everyone on her bus sings Help, she gets a glimpse at the inner pain of a hot new coworker when he sings Mad World alone after hours at his desk.
Speaking of Everwood.
Yeah, she's finally convinced that her father is conscious despite being catatonic when he sings True Colors to her, or, you know, in her fantasy or whatever. There are more bad, obvious song choices, but you get it. Lauren Graham plays Zoe's boss at this tech company where she works and is not credible as a charge-charging type A tech boss at all.
Yeah.
I'm also sad this is what Mary Steen Virgin is doing after getting to be so fun as a drunk lesbian in The Last Man on Earth. But truly, the worst thing about it is the music. And when we're coming off four seasons of storytelling through all original songs in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, storytelling through literally the first song titles that come up when you Google a mood or an idea is so lazy and unambitious, like it makes you mad to watch it. One more. Zoe's previously sexless friend, who is played by Crazy Ex-Girlfriend alumnus Skylar Astin, blows her mind with his inner monologue right at the end of the first episode, which is, "I think I love you." And I really do like musicals. I don't even mind jukebox musicals, but this is so, 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 so lazy. I cannot warn you all against it enough.
I think you've told how bad it is, but I don't think you've haven't touched on the cringe worthiness of what's going
on. Okay, please.
No, I'm just saying, like, to watch it, you're like, really? This actually happened. This is like a high school level, like, production. It is the equivalent of writing the poem, you know, the barn door is creaking. Creaking.
Yeah. So many talented people are involved in it. It's like, what did you see that is not on the screen? Because it's so, so bad.
And it does feel like that it's been sort of teased and promoted for like a year and a half. So they had like plenty of time to not only get all the rights to these on the nose music choices, but to then decide this idea is really stupid and not do it.
Yeah.
Like, I am cringing listening to that. I really can't believe it's an hour.
It's brutal. So the real premiere in its time slot is February 16th, but I'm only telling you that so you can mark your calendar to not watch it. It's so bad. Do not watch it. Do not watch Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. I cannot stress this enough. It's fucking terrible. For my plugs, I have two posts going up this week on Primetimer. One about why Dex on Stumptown is your hot bisexual crush. Basically, the horny person's guide to Stumptown. And one inspired by Medical Police, the new children's hospital / 24 spoof show on Netflix. If you're looking for other kind of spoof TV shows to watch, I'm going to have a roundup of all of those. So look out for both of those on Primetimer. They are not up as of this recording, but they will be up this week. Primetimer.com.
All right, Meredith, your turn.
So since civilization is crumbling on an hourly, if not minutely basis, escaping into formulaic TV is like necessary, and it's better than snuggling into a cozy robe or a handle of vodka. But I think you should combine all three. And if your TV escape fears towards HGTV, but you're kind of over the Property Brothers, I would like to suggest that you turn to Grand Designs. I discovered it about a year ago on Netflix. And when I got really stressed out about work a couple days ago, what did I go back to? While those of us here in the States might not be familiar with it, it's actually a 20-year-old British reality show, very famous, about folks who are designing and building their own homes. But the design always has something notable to it, like this house is shaped like the spiral of a shell, or it will have no carbon footprint, or I'm a crazy person who's making a 10,000 square foot house out of mud and straw by hand. And
oh my God.
Then his wife divorces him in the middle, and you're kind of like, yeah. there's always a formula to the show. They go from design to following the build, and then stuff goes wrong, and either they cope or don't, and then we see the finished product. But the formula isn't static the way that HGTV is, because the things that go wrong are never manufactured, and they aren't built around like commercial break tension. Instead, you'll also see issues with finances and budgets and people actually struggling with how do I afford all of this. And a few times, the episode ends on a total failure, where either entire sections or the whole house hasn't been finished. And that's a real reality check about how huge and difficult these projects are that you don't really get a sense of on a lot of these home building shows. But for me, the real reason to turn to Grand Designs is the host, Kevin MacLeod, who is always wearing so many layers of outerwear. It's like sartorial inception, just layer on layer.
England.
And often he wears a scarf that isn't exactly decorative, but is yet so unsubstantial that calling it an actual scarf is an insult to true winter wear. I just love it. Kevin is so horny for good architecture, and he speaks way too often about design, like he's trying to get those supple lines of the trellis to go home with him tonight. He is constantly cynical, but not in a toxic way, when the homeowner tells him that they have a plan to renovate a 12-story Victorian-era water tower in a single year. I mean, it's a skepticism that all of us would have in the face of such utter delusion. So his excitement and his horniness over good progress, and sometimes, well, he always gives a monologue at the end, and sometimes it's satisfying, and sometimes it's so hilariously overwrought, where he tries to attempt to tie architecture and home building to the meaning of life. He's like that English major who takes the text way too seriously, but is still a really fun hang at parties. He is absolutely my favorite. How much do I love this show? When I was in England back in October, my best friend and I had all kinds of plans to go to Stonehenge and Cambridge and an overnight trip to Dublin to see a DJ. But instead, we stayed at her house in West Sussex, polished off the rest of the wedding wine, and marathoned Three Seasons. It was the best vacation of my entire life. So here in the States, we're currently limited to two seasons through Netflix. It says it's 10 and 15, but my best friend, the Brit, says those aren't the real numbers. So if you get infected with the Grand Designs bug and need to see more than those two seasons, you can find them through some corners of the internet. Mm-hmm. But Canadians, I read online that you might have access to every season. And if so, please let me know immediately, because you bet your ass I will be on a flight to Montreal as soon as possible to lay in an Airbnb and binge as many seasons as I can while binging Fairmont bagels. So please let me know if Kevin is available. I've got a couple days off for Mardi Gras. I'd like to come.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Speaking of Netflix shows, this will not be long. I am talking about Cheer. It is not, as people joked on Twitter, a prequel to Cheers. Alas, it is Bring It On meets Last Chance U. It's actually literally that. There are a bunch of Bring It On name drops in the first episode, and it is made by the co-creators of Last Chance U, one of whom directs or co-directs most of the six episodes. It's basically the trip of a junior college cheer team that is, you know, a 13-time national champion and a legendary program. It's their journey to the national championships in Daytona. It's suspenseful. It's heart-wrenching. I should mention that there is discussion of childhood abuse and suicidal ideations, plural, amongst some of the team members in their sort of spotlight sections. So watch with care. But it is also thrilling in the way of all the best narratives of sport. And Jerry is the goddamn best.
Jerry!
I just, like, every time he even passed through the background of a shot, like, out of focus, I was like, Jerry! And, like, little heart cartoon emoji things happened to my face. I mean, everyone's the best. Morgan is also the best, but yes. Morgan's family is the worst, and I kind of want to track them down and fire them into the sun. Not her grandparents.
I'll assist.
My only nitpick is that I could have used some of the tumbling and gymnastics terminology explained or chironed a little more clearly, but I'm a grown up and I could Google those things. Overall, it is 6 hours, absolutely well spent. It is everything that I dreamed and more. I recommend it. And if you watched it and agree with me that it's great and that Jerry needs to run for president, tweet me. At Tomato Nation, speaking of the subjects of excellent documentaries, on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, we're talking about Nina Simone's Wild as the Wind in our most recent episode, and we're joined for that by special guest Eli Oberman of Low Tide and the Shundas. He also joined us for Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind, so I guess he's just going to come back every time we talk about a song with wind in the title. So all of you have been waiting for us to talk about They Call the Wind Mariah. Like, send us your cards and letters. We read everyone. Anyway, that's Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. Me and my co-host, Mark Blankenship. And that's wherever you get your podcasts.
is time for the canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Meredith. Take it away, Meredith.
Thank you, Dave. So I thought incredibly hard about what to submit today, sorting through about a million different options, including Scrubs and ER and The Bold Type. Shut up, don't at me, it's amazing. But there was one show that I just couldn't shake and couldn't resist. And you know what, Dave, could you please play clip one to intro it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, kids. It's time for Motherfucking Murder, She Wrote. I'm so excited to present Season 4, Episode 7. If it's Thursday, it must be Beverly. The canon worthiness of Murder, She Wrote is obvious. I mean, it's an institution, having run for 12 years on CBS. And it should have gone longer had Les Moonves, the monster, and his horrible sexism not intervened. It's hard to say that the show ended too soon, but, you know, we could be talking about an SVU-style run instead of the 12 seasons we got. And that's a travesty. And Angela Lansbury's Jessica Fletcher is an institution in itself. And she fought to keep her character sophisticated and single. More than that, it's so comfortable. And when I think of Murder, She Wrote, I think of my Nana and being at her house in Michigan and laying on the couch in the basement because it's an old lady thing and thinking that Jessica's nephew Grady kind of sucks. That's what I remember. So it was hard for me, though, to pick an episode of Murder, She Wrote, because while it is procedural, I mean, every episode has that central murder mystery to solve, the trappings can shift. I mean, you could have an episode that's set in Jessica's hometown of Cabot Cove, Maine, or her adopted hometown of New York. It could be set where she's around the country or world visiting her 1,700 nieces and nephews and former students and friends and dog sitters. It could be about Jessica's identical cousin, the boozy British actress Emma McGill. Hell, it could be one of those episodes that are entirely about other people, like those ones about her friend, the former cat burglar, though I totally had a soft spot for those episodes because don't sleep on the foxiness of a 55-year-old man with an accent, you know? But still, I did choose an episode, and I picked one that was set in Cabot Cove. When I think... I think Murder, She Wrote is going to need a second canon episode, one where Jessica's out in the world. But if you talk to people who don't know the show, they're all like, oh, yeah, you mean the show with Mrs. Potts, where she lived in that town where everybody dies. Accurate. Actually, the BBC calculated that Cabot Cove has a murder rate 60% higher than that of Honduras, where a person is killed every 74 minutes. Now, how this never... How this didn't tank Maine's tourism is beyond me, because like when I went there last summer for vacation, I totally anticipated dying. Though the closest I came to death was having so much lobster that it triggered an allergic reaction, which I assure you is absolutely how you want to die. Anyway, the episode has to be set in Cabot Cove. So to get into the rest of the reasons why this episode is canon worthy, I'm going to need to spoil the plot a bit. So like, go watch the episode and then come back if you don't want to be spoiled. Okay, cool. Welcome back. All right. So here's your 30-second plot description. Shout out to this had Oscar buzz. In good old Murderville, a.k.a. Cabot Cove, Audrey Martin, the wife of the night deputy sheriff, is murdered. At first glance, it seems like suicide, but the title of the show is Murder, She Wrote. So what do you think? Jessica clocks to the homicide of it all very fast, and suspicion soon falls on her husband, Jonathan, since he was suspiciously out of contact during the time of the killing. Inspection of his activity logs quickly shows that he wasn't disappearing for an hour or two every night to help local women find lost dogs or get their cats out of trees. Here, let's let clip two explain.
Eve, according to the sheriff's logbook, Deputy Martin stopped in to help you with your cat on a fairly regular basis.
Oh, she's a very bad cat. And the deputy seems to have a way with her.
I don't get it.
Yeah, music sting. You know what's up. Wait, was that too unclear, though? How about I clear things up in clip three?
It was good, clean sex once a week.
That's right, kids. This episode is all about old people fucking. But It's actually a ruse because Jonathan Martin didn't kill his wife so he could continue giving the over 60 set in Cabot Cove the night watch. It was all a misdirect. The B plot about the ladies playing the New Hampshire lottery is where the story of the murder actually lay. And it was the mailman who sold Audrey a lottery ticket that he bought across state lines. He killed her because he knew that she had the winning ticket. Then the show ends on a freeze frame of Jessica laughing because the fact she lives amongst killers is hilarious. Anyway, with that out of the way, I think the canon worthiness is centered around the show's examples of what I'd like to call peak Murder, She Wrote. Like I said, the form of the story could change a lot, so it's hard to say what has to be in the essential, you know, like the meat of the episode. I mean, you could say that Murder, She Wrote always had great guest stars, like the episode that had Jerry Orbach, Adam West, LeVar Burton, Ernest Borgnine, and Admiral Fitzwallace. But since the writers of the show knew that a single high-profile guest star was assigned to the audience that that's your killer, Cabot Cove episodes won't have guest stars like that because the town's regulars are played by character actors. That guest star would stick out. Instead, I think these peak Murder, She Wrote elements are broader, and this episode has them in spades. First, like I said, this one is set in Cabot Cove. And so in a Cabot Cove episode, it's essential that it have wacky town hijinks, you know, the real character of the town. In fact, this episode is what I think of. The beauty parlor gang and all of the town gossip is integral to that plot. And also, I find Seth to be an essential element, too, so he has to be around. Second, an episode has to give me really good Fletcher face. I mean, Angela Lansbury never misses a moment to put an extra dollop of relish on every reaction shot, you know? But this is beyond that. It's like every time she pulls a face that would make an excellent reaction gif, and I probably have used that gif too. I count four hashtag Fletcher faces. First, in reaction to Amos Tupper's sexism. Second, in reaction to figuring out that Jonathan Martin was polishing his badge with Eve Simpson. Third, in reaction to Ideal Malloy breaking down over the divorce movie. That was a classic. And fourth, Beverly's declaration that we heard already. And I'd argue that the episode even ends on Fletcher face when Jessica reacts to Seth goading Amos into trying snails. Third, the mystery needs to be one that we could solve. Even people who are terrible at solving mysteries, like I, sitting right here. Now, for those of us who are bad at mysteries, it makes the need for the entertaining factor to be high more important. And I argued it previously in points one and two. This episode does provide that. But this show is ostensibly about solving the titular murder of the weeks, and that murder plot then should at least hang together. The showrunner for the first seven seasons was a big murder mystery buff, and you see stronger mystery plots in this half of the show's run. Well, I read that. I wouldn't remember since Amazon Prime is holding back seasons 6 through 12 in what is clearly a personal attack against me. Anyway, this season 4 episode has a particularly good mystery where the story misdirects your attention to the sex of it all and keeps it there until Jessica reveals who actually done it. Now, I bet, though, the three of you will all say that you knew who the killer was all along, to which I say, oh, yeah, so you're so much better than me, which you are, because I thought Jonathan totally did it. And then I thought it was Loretta. But the reveals were there all along if you were paying attention. That close-up of the bulletin board where you could spot that the ticket was missing and guess that the killer stole it. Figuring out the missing New Hampshire weeklies would have those lottery results in them. So you can put together that the mailman with those weeklies disappearance. I think this is one of the better mysteries that the show has actually done. And fourth, and maybe controversially, but I'd argue that it's essential to see Jessica kick sexist ass. Too many of the episodes in the 80s and the early 90s displayed the normalized sexism of the time. And this episode's from 1987, and it really shows. We're barely past Meritor v. Vinson here, if you're a legal nerd, which I am, and so I'm alone. But even while the show is a reflection of the times in that context, Jessica is the answer. Her competence is constantly noticed. I mean, Sheriff Amos Tupper couldn't find his damn hat without Jessica handing it to him. Like here, in clip 4, where Jessica has to remind the dude to, like, count.
No, Miss Fletcher, he is surely as guilty as that Bluebeard fella. And if he thinks he can get away with this kind of a murder and these kind of adventures, well, he's got another thing coming.
Amos, I thought you ought to take a look here.
Tuesday nights it's Simpson, Monday nights it's Ideal Malloy. And I distinctly remember I asked her to the picture show last Monday. She said she had to wash her hair.
Amos, there are more than 2 days in the week.
Oh,
Oh, yes. But this episode shows how his obnoxious sexism gets in the way of, like, doing his job. In a lot of episodes, it's so contrived how Jessica gets to be involved in the investigation. Okay, fair. It's always contrived, but some circumstances give a more plausible, implausible explanation. And here it's that Happy Days is, let's say, ill-equipped to function in his role as detective and kind of incel-y with his discomfort with the beauty shop ladies. So Jessica has to do his damn job for him. No, they weren't all Happy Days. Thank you. Thank you. Though I do think that Amos redeems himself when the mailman tries to bro it up with him at the end by saying, you know, Jessica's making this all up. And Amos says that he believes Jessica, which, of course, is the least he can do. But, you know, I'm grasping at straws some days for rays of light. And that the year of our Lord 20, no Equal Rights Amendment 20, sometimes it's really nice to see a competent, compassionate woman bat away the sexism and win. Actually, this whole show just makes me feel good, like visiting Nana's house good. And since this is the platonic ideal of Cabot Cove episodes, Murder, She Wrote is just at its absolute best. And who would think that murder would make you feel so good? So, Sarah, Dave, Tara, I implore you to vote this episode of Murder, She Wrote into the canon. But, oh, wait, P.S. Do you know how Jessica's pen name is J.B. Fletcher? J.B. Jessica Beatrice. Angela Lansbury made Jessica's middle name Beatrice in honor of her close friend, B. Arthur. Bam! Sarah, how can you vote against that? Honestly, the end.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Another amazing presentation.
Thank you.
Sarah, you should go first.
All right. What I liked about this is, like, often when you watch these older shows that are 47 minutes instead of the 41 that we're now used to, you really notice a lot of just like filler. Like there's a scene where Jessica is like, oh, my neck hurts. I'm typing. My neck hurts. Oh, there's the door. Like they would never leave that in anymore. But in this show, like it all works to give you the texture of it. And there are little moments like when they're talking about Tom Bosley returning her late husband's fishing guide. And she's like, very highly rated. 3 trout. Like, there's just little things that they don't do a lot of explaining of that I enjoy. There's a very 70s and 80s reference to escargot as like the ne plus ultra of like snobby, scary fur and food. Uh-huh. There's the I forgot you feminists hate alimony line, which I just thought was like so bitchy and the group-y. And there's the presence of Ruth Roman as Loretta. You could argue that Elizabeth Ashley herself is the poor man's Elizabeth Ashley, but I would say Ruth Roman was like Elizabeth Ashley Senior. Or like the proto Elizabeth Ashley. Either way, any Elizabeth Ashley is good, in my opinion. This also reminded me of being at my grandma's for that week or 10 days in the summer and just like lying on the floor of her den, because that was the coolest place in the house, with a bowl of orange sherbet and watching Murder, She Wrote and arguing over who we thought the killer was. And for the record, I didn't figure it out until they started the reveal. Then I was like, oh, of course. But then it holds up, which is something else that I remember about this show, is that even when it's outlandish, if you fill it with water, it still works. So this was really a fun 47 minutes. Yes, it's dated, but I think in ways that like were nostalgic mostly versus cringy and sexist and unpleasant.
Just to piggyback on one of the things you were saying to back up that point, I was thinking during the calamari scene where Tom Bosley almost faints because he just ate squid and, you know, the music's like, doop, 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 yeah, doop, doop, doop. It reminded me that this episode is probably roughly contemporary with the McSushi commercial from Saturday Night Live.
And yes.
The whole point of that commercial
yeah, I think
was
you're right.
McDonald's is going to serve you sushi. Like that was the whole, like there wasn't really much more context to that whole bit. And it was just like, well, looks like we're getting some crazy ideas with our food lately, isn't it? And it was just like, the 80s, you little scamp.
Well, it's like Molly Ringwald's character in Breakfast Club having a bento box. Like yeah, that was her whole character brief, basically. That and the boots that cost $300. Like anyway, mostly I felt that these were like little sort of ticks. Like you would see this kind of escargot-based quote humor on Chips as well. But here it's actually well done. So this was a delight to watch and a true delight in the presentation as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
I will go next. This was such a treat. So much fun. I am probably, other than Dave, the least Murder, She Wrote conversant among all of us. So getting to watch a Cabot Cove episode, it was definitely the right choice for this panel, I think. And I agree with Sarah that it all of the detail serves to, you know, make the world, give the world all of its dimensionality. And even in the little elements, like you said, with her sore neck, it's like, well, she's a writer. Like, this is her, we're seeing her writer's life. Like, she can cut away during the day and go and get her hair done with all the gals because, you know, she doesn't keep set hours and she, for some reason, you know, still uses a typewriter at her dining room table, which, whatever, that's her, you know, her eccentricity, fine. But what struck me about this episode, and as soon as you see all of the gals at the beauty salon, which was like the best, this coven of like 50 and 60 something broads, like just laughing it up on a Tuesday at the salon, is that, you know, there's a gigolo somewhere around here. Sure enough.
Yeah.
Fucking Jonathan. And like how actually risque it is was surprising to me. Like the line that Cindy Walsh's mother gets about, like, well, she's a very naughty kitty, was like, wow, that's actually pretty brazen. By the way,
Beverly's last name, according to the IMDb, is Hills.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
Oh, nice.
Thank you.
Love it. But at the same time, like the laughs are about the situation. It's not, there's, the joke isn't like all of these older ladies need to get service. Is like, well, he's providing a service. You know, like the joke isn't that they're old and they're having sex. It's just that this is part of, like, this is what happens in Cabot Cove. And, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been falsifying his logbook to do it. But you know what? Naughty girls need love too. So
every other able-dicked man has been killed. So
so true.
Get it while you can. So true.
But the other important thing that the episode establishes is that even Jessica is susceptible to his charms when he comes over and starts massaging her. Like, she almost goes with it. Like, this guy knows what he is doing in and out of the bedroom. God bless Jonathan Martin and his millions of dollars. Go service ladies across the continent now that you have won the lottery thanks to your dead wife.
Hear it all.
This was so much fun, and I didn't solve the mystery either, for the record. So thank you for bringing this to us. Dave.
Sarah just described this as a delight. Tara just said it was fun. I think you're both missing the quintessential word to describe this episode, which is hoot. This was a
It's a hoot.
It is a hoot. You're correct.
I'm tempted just to leave it at hoot, but I do have a couple.
I might have hooted.
Jessica is a pistol. Uh-huh.
I have a couple random notes. Jonathan, upon entering the room with the body, immediately hugs it, which seems like a very strange move for a police detective to do. And nobody sort of says, Jonathan, please do not hug the evidence. That's something nobody says. This episode does have some fantastic props. All the fake magazines are really great. Screen Idol, etc. They are non-generic enough to be believable for the 80s in a way that when you see modern examples of typography and design, it doesn't really work. Like, there's not enough effort put into them, but magazines were like relatively primitive enough looking back then that these still worked. You know what I mean? Except for, oddly, even though the magazine is really good, the Best Fishing Spots book had a totally blank back cover, which is...
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Really?
I guess they couldn't get anyone to blurb it. This book sucks, a fish.
I will say that my favorite part of this episode was a little detail in the salon. There is a poster. You know, they have all the posters of hairstyles and whatnot. There's this one that I can only describe as Red Rooster Lady. That is so out of place with all the other examples, but also for this town. Like, I really wanted to see, like, it is like, if Grace Jones was a white woman with red hair, that would be like this, that there's the picture. To see one of these old broads with that styling would have been fantastic, but alas.
Dave was obsessed with this poster, you guys. I'm not joking.
I'm going to put it in the show notes for you, dear listener.
Your birthday's coming up.
Anyways, this episode was fun. It's obviously, you know, the canon works on different scales, and it's all relative. I'm always reminded about the guy who got really angry on the Game of Thrones episode, in which we also inducted the 90210 episode. It's just the way it works, buddy. This show is not like Breaking Bad, but that's fine. It is fun, it is enjoyable. And if you like your 80s entertainment full of cutesy poo little sexual innuendos, hey, have at it. This one's got them all. It was fun. And I think my previous exposure to Murder, She Wrote prior to this was the Magnum PI crossover episode, period. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of fun to see it all in its own element. So I'm going to say that's a yes vote for me. Sarah D. Bunting.
Three trout and a yes for me.
Tara Ariano.
I'm as hot for this episode as Jonathan Martin's pants. Yes for me as well.
All right. What? All right. Murder, She Wrote, Season 4, Episode 7. If it's Thursday, it must be Beverly. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot, great canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Sarah has the winner.
I sure do. It's the Saved by the Bell revival, which will have Mark Paul Gosselaar for at least three episodes. He was weirdly my favorite thing about Pitch. And I've been a big fan ever since I saw him in Roundabout Theater production. I never watched the original Saved by the Bell, but I might actually watch this because of him. Because I love him.
Nice.
And loser?
Well, this was a weird one. Last Friday, it was announced that Justin Chambers, who has been on Grey's Anatomy playing Alex Karev since the beginning of the show, A, was leaving, and B, his final episode had already aired in November with like zero fanfare or any kind of like writing him out. So, you know, I feel like when something like this happens in the year 2020 or 2019, as it was, we all might make some guesses as to what could have happened. But it's very, very weird that this timing, like that there was this much of a gap between when his last episode aired and when this came out. So either, you know, something terrible happened that he did, in which case, like, it's a weird way to cover it up, or something terrible happened that's not his fault, in which case they're kind of like screwing over his character and really not giving him a nice exit if it's, you know, some kind of health crisis or whatever. All of it is very strange. Clearly there's more to the story that's yet to come out, but all of it was like really cast a pall over Grey's Anatomy in the production, and everyone just has questions, and it's very strange.
What is your theory?
Nothing that I want to say into a microphone, that's for sure.
Oh, so okay. There's something odd. You know, they left the character where he was out of town visiting his sick mom. So, So you have to wonder if they already were giving him time to be away from the show.
Right. That's also how they wrote Lori Loughlin out of When Calls the Heart. So eyes emoji. Maybe he also was trying to get his kid into an elite school. Who knows?
Oh, dear.
He's got five of them.
Oh, God. Wow. Maybe that's his mental health issue. He's just very tired and needs sleep.
Speaking about being very tired and needing your sleep, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Game time.
This is the seventh game time of the season. Standings are Sarah in first place with 3 points, Value Guess in second with 2 points, and Tara in third place with 1 point. Today we are playing TV Dinners from Chris Bilfig and Dan Cashuno, who earned themselves an extra credit topic.
I get it.
They write, if there's one thing we love more than TV, it's food. And if there's one thing we love more than food, it's puns. So to bring all our loves together, we've put together a set of food-based TV title puns. I will give you the description, you give the pun title. So, for example, if the show was about a dystopian future in which women have to pretend to like basically inedible but trendy greens, you'd know it was...
The Handmaid's
Kale, correct.
Wow.
No clues, lots of groans, 36 questions, and a tiebreaker. Tara Ariano, steel mill situation, please.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you, Meredith, but Nick cleaned you out of steel meals last week, so valued guests have zero. Sarah D. Bunting has one steel meal. I have one steel meal plus one extravaganza gong.
I promised Nick that we would turn Reinwolding into a verb for clearing out your steel meals.
Yes, you got Reinwald Jones'd.
Let's throw this to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. Meredith is starting today, and then we'll go to Sarah, then Tara. Are we ready to play TV dinners?
Yes.
Here we go. Starting with Meredith, I will give you the synopsis of the food-based TV show. You name the punny title. Noble houses kill and die to claim the rulership symbolized by a starchy British breakfast treat.
Oh, man. Starchy British breakfast treat?
Yeah. Noble houses kill and die to claim the rulership symbolized by a starchy British breakfast treat.
Nope. Gotta give up on this one.
Anybody for shits and giggles?
Game of scones?
Game of scones, yes.
God damn it.
That's the spirit.
I mean, it's bad because, but also it's bad because my British best friend is going to come for me now. Okay,
and
cool.
You're eating a scone right now.
Incredibly embarrassing. I am.
Sarah D. Bunting, here is your first question. The Almighty is on Facebook, and they, capital T, love a triple cream French cheese.
Proof that they love us and want us to be happy. God-friended Brie?
Correct.
Nice.
God-friended Brie. Tara, your first question. Mm-hmm. A 40-year-old joins the police department, but can he balance the demands of his new profession with his love of sweet, round bakery treats?
The cookie.
The cookie is correct.
Nathan Fillion is the cookie.
The cookie. Meredith, your second question. Nazis conquer America after an alternate World War II, but the real mystery is the custard dessert at the heart of the empire. Now, depending how you pronounce things, you may have to work this a bit.
Okay. So it's the man in the high castle. So... Custard?
Custard dessert at the heart of the empire.
Creme brulee. What? Now I'm thinking about creme brulee.
Yeah, you're close.
But I can't figure out. Pardon?
I said you're close.
Oh. Damn it.
You're into the dessert area.
I'm within spelling difference of the patisserie. The man in the high castle, the man in the... Yeah, okay, tell me the answers that way I can hate myself.
Steel meal.
Steel meal from Sarah.
The flan in the high castle.
No!
The flan or flan, depending on how you want to work that one, in the high castle is correct.
Good job.
Sarah D. Bunting with the excellent steel meal, and here is your real question. With gang members like Kaiser, Cinnamon, Burger, and Hot Cross, this motorcycle club was able to corner the local drug trade.
Hot Cross Bunting is actually my drag name. That's Buns of Anarchy.
Buns of Anarchy. Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Pioneers in criminal profiling try to get police to buy their theories about serial killers and the outside edges of cheese wheels.
Rind Hunter.
Oh, wow.
Correct. Oh, my God.
Back to Meredith. A Rhode Island family and their talking dog get off on a lot of tangents, but they come together for the taste of dense Jewish sandwich bread.
Okay, so that's probably rye. Talking dog.
Rhode Island family and their talking dog.
Rhode, that is the only thing I can think of set in Rhode Island was that awful show Providence. So I think I'm out of luck. Man, 0 for 3.
Can you work it the other way? Shows with talking dogs.
Shows with talking... Well, then I'm Oh! Family Rye! Oh! Jane!
Yay!
Yay!
You are correct. Family Rye from Family Guy. Sarah D. Bunting? Spanish criminals take over the apiary, and the longer they stay inside, the more sweetness they be getting.
Honey heist?
Yeah.
Tara Ariano. Andrea gets real pedantic about how the other students in the Beverly Hills High cafeteria pronounce the name of her favorite Vietnamese soup.
9021
fe. Yes. Fe, fa, fo. Meredith. An unnamed New Yorker observes the lives of Gothamites while delivering on bike their spiced tea fixes.
Okay, I know the show, but I can't remember the title. Is it Chai? It must be High and Chai. Is it Chai Times? No, that's not it. Oh, I had such a great high before, and now we're crashing down to a low.
All right, the show we were looking for, Chai, correct. The word he couldn't pull, maintenance. High maintenance,
damn
Chai
it.
Maintenance. And I know Chai just means tea, but come on. We all live in the real world. Here, Chai is masala chai, so deal with it. I don't want any angry emails. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Judge Hirsch puts away so much Pabst Blue Ribbon that his wife leaves him.
Judge Hirsch puts away so much Pabst Blue Ribbon. Oh my God. Numb beers? That's not it. It's beer someone, but I can't remember the name.
Beer John.
Oh.
Tara, wow. Last question before our first score break. An older British couple reconnects and marries with the help of some tropical fruit.
I feel like this is a British show that I don't know. Last of the Summer Wine. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I don't know what the show
you
is.
You had it there. Last Mango in Halifax.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I couldn't pull the name either.
All right. That is our one-third mark. Score break, please, Tara.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting is in the lead with 4. I have 3. Meredith has 1.
All right, Meredith. Guess what? 1. That means you are in.
Woo! Yes.
The Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Answer half of these TV Trivial Pursuit questions correctly, and we'll give you 2 points. Sweep it, and we're going to give you 4. Here we go.
Ooh.
Classics. What show's announcer asserted that the program was created to help stem the rising tide of divorces?
I don't know. It sounds like a buzzkill, though.
What show's announcer asserted that the program was created to help stem the rising tide of divorces? Don't overthink it.
That's too late. You know what? Ed McMahon. Why not? He's who I think of.
No, what show? The show we're looking for.
What show? Never mind. Show Rising Tide, The Brady Bunch?
Divorce Court.
Oh.
Sitcoms. What's Gregory Harrison's occupation in the 1991 sitcom Family Man?
Garbage collector.
Close firefighter.
Oh, yeah, those two are related.
Drama. What's government agent Lee Stetson's code name?
Stetson. That makes me think of Texas. So Texas? Lone Star?
Scarecrow.
And Mrs. King?
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh.
All right, that means you got to get all 3 of these for your points.
Totally doable.
Kids and Games. What show takes kids on trips to the neighborhood of make-believe?
Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yay!
Yay!
Stars. What future CBS and ABC news star was an aide to Richard Nixon for nearly 8 years?
Oh, boy. That doesn't sound like Peter Jennings. CBS?
CBS and ABC news star ABC? Was an aide to Nixon for nearly 8 years.
David Brinkley?
Incorrect. Diane Sawyer. Diane Sawyer. All right. You didn't get your points. So we're going to get back to the game. And it is, in fact, still your real question, Meredith. So don't shut down that brain just yet. Here we go. A Midwestern transplant ignores warnings and winds up entangled with a narcissist, an egotistical James Vanderbeek, and their unnatural fascination with a green legume.
Don't just the pee in apartment 23.
Oh. Sarah D. Bunting. Colby Jack Tripper moves in with Chrissy Queso and Janet Gouda.
Cheese company?
Correct. Tara. Thanks to their inventive neighbors' automation efforts, the Winslow's specialty food business is booming, with options including beer, tempura, pakoda, dosa, and pancake.
Family Batters.
Correct.
Wow.
Back to Meredith. The Monterey Five are caught up in the investigation into the murder of Marie Colander.
Big Little Pies.
This is question 17, everybody.
Spread eagle.
This might be too punny. Ham Dauber and Robin Wilhams star in the spinoff of Hoggy Days.
Pork and Mindy.
Yeah, sure.
That's amazing.
Tara. Oh. This show follows programmers at the dawn of the computer era using chips made from sodium chloride rather than silicon.
Salt and Catch Fire.
Correct.
Nice.
Back to Meredith for question. Ryan Murphy-led anthology series which dramatically recreates citrus-based crimes.
So this is probably American Crime Story.
Citrus-based crimes.
Really wish I had stopped turning down my project manager's oranges now. American Lime Story.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Amy Mart, shout out.
Word.
For Sarah, Jessica Parker and Jamie Gertz are incredible and edible in this early 80s sitcom.
Oh my God, that could be it. Oh, wait. No, it couldn't be anything. Square Eggs.
Square Eggs. Nope. Edible, incredible nice. Eggs. Correct. Tara. One season wonder in which nerdy teens find common ground with scallion-related vegetables.
Freaks and Leeks.
Freaks and Leeks is correct. Back to Meredith. You are about to enter another dimension. A dimension not only of waffle or cake, but of mind. Your next stop is...
The Twilight Cone?
The Twilight Cone. Sarah D. Bunting. David Boreanaz leads a crack team of milk-fed baby cows. When they die, it's sad, but so, so tender.
Jesus. Veal Team?
Veal Team, correct. This is for Tara, taking us into our second score break. To survive, Liv Moore must consume what's left at the bottom of the fast food bags of the dead.
Fry Zombie?
Fry Zombie is correct. Oh, and it is time for the scores. Please start.
All right. Sarah is still in the lead with 8. I have 7. Meredith has 5.
Ooh, catching up and a chance to get even closer because, Meredith, you are once again in.
Yes!
The Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Here we go. Classics is your first category. What word ends the jingle? Oh, we're the men of Texaco. We work from Maine to...
Californexico? California?
Mexico. Texaco, Mexico. Sitcoms. What section of Brooklyn did Ralph Cramden live in?
What section of Brooklyn?
Yeah, what neighborhood? Yeah.
Williamsburg?
Bensonhurst. Drama. What 1988 pilot based on Psycho failed to cut it with network execs? Huh. Interesting. I'm going to say, huh, interesting, and maybe you can figure out the name of it from there.
Huh. So my first thought was Norman with an exclamation point.
Sarah point.
God, I wish.
I don't think they do Bates Motel, but that's my best guess.
Your answer is Bates Motel?
Yeah, why not?
Yay!
Yay!
Kids All and right. Games. What was the first game show to give away a baby camel?
Wait, they were giving away the baby camels?
What was the first game show to give away a baby camel? Easy once you know the answer.
Kids and Games.
Kids and Games.
You know what? I know this isn't true, but I just wish it were. Hollywood Squares.
No. Also, probably the first game to give away a donkey. That is Let's Make a Deal.
Yeah.
All right. You need these last two?
Yes.
Who played Barbara Stanwyck's daughter in The Big Valley before marrying John Forsythe in Dynasty? Looking for the actor.
Oh, Dynasty.
Yeah. I don't know anyone from the old Dynasty. So
this is going to be tough.
I'm going to steal from Sarah Benson.
Incorrect. We were looking for Linda Evans. Linda Evans.
Damn.
Sorry, once again, no points for you in the Gross Horse Collector Challenge Zone, but we still got a bit of game left. Still got one third of this baby to go. And it's back to you, Meredith.
All right.
Shirtless lycanthropes keep in shape with a diet consisting entirely of kidneys and pintos. Of course, when they pass gas, they can't really blame it on the dog since they kind of are the dog.
Bean Wolf.
Bean Wolf. Good for a
Bean
point.
Bean Wolf.
Sarah D. Bunting. Kristen Dunst's new pyramid scheme involves convincing rubes to fill up their garages with dense, white, flaky fish.
Oh, God. We covered this on the show, and now I can't remember the name of it. Dense, white, flaky fish. How to become a cod in Central Florida? I just don't remember the whole name of the show. Sorry.
You're very close. On becoming a cod in Central Florida.
Okay.
Very close. Tara, yeah. Giovanni Ribisi stars in this Amazon series about a convict with a preoccupation with deep red root vegetables.
Sneaky Beat.
Sneaky Beat. Correct. Back to Meredith. Florida cops pursue smugglers flooding the streets with fake arborio, basmati, and jasmine.
While wearing really, really big boxy blazers as they do it. Miami Rice.
Miami Rice, you are correct. To Sarah. Superheroic billionaire Xander Cruz finds out that his show was canceled after just 2 seasons and drowns his sorrows in scotch.
Whiskey Dingo.
Tara?
Yes.
90s NBC sitcom about a beantown transplant who loves Japanese noodle dishes.
Boston Ramen.
Boston Common, Boston Ramen. To Meredith. In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by 2 separate yet equally important groups. The chopped salads of raw cabbage with a vinegar-based dressing, and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders.
Okay. I mean, clearly I know what it is, Chung Chung, but what's the food pun? Okay. Dave, could you repeat that one more time?
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by 2 separate yet equally important groups. The chopped salads of raw cabbage with a vinegar-based dressing, and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders.
Could that be coleslaw and order?
Slaw and order is what we're looking for. Contained in your answer, so we'll give it to you. One point. Nice.
Thank you.
Sarah D. Bunting. Horror spinoff where Jenna Elfman and Ruben Blades, among others, fend off hordes of killer carbohydrates.
Were they what?
Fend off hordes of killer carbohydrates.
Fear the walking bread?
Correct.
I do every day.
Back to Tara. Looks like them country gourds are at it again, and Boss Hogg can't stop them. Seedless, picklin', slicin', they're all one jump away from the county line.
Oh, no. I know the show, but I don't know the food. It's the Dukes of Hazzard. The Cukes of Hazzard?
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
All right, everybody's last question coming at you, so Tara, can I please get the scores quickly?
It's very exciting, Dave. Meredith has 8 points. Sarah and I are tied with 10.
All right, here we go. Meredith, your last question. After an unexpected suicide, friends and family tend to friends and family come together over piles of chicken, ranch dressing, and celery sticks.
Wing. Okay, so that's wings, chicken wings. Suicide.
Yeah. After an unexpected suicide, friends and family come together over piles of chicken, ranch dressing, and celery sticks.
I can only think of Desperate House Wings, but that's...
No, that's not it. Anybody?
A Million Little Wings.
A Little Million Things. A Little Million.
Oh, that thing.
All right, Sarah, get this and you'll be in the lead. Rob Estes and Mitzi Capture are sexy cops trying to cleanse Palm Beach of unpasteurized and adulterated dairy products.
Wow. I'm so lucky that my dad loved this show. Is this Milk Stockings?
Milk Stockings from Silk Stockings is correct.
Wow.
That puts the pressure on Tara.
Ooh. Okay.
You need to get this to keep it tied.
Yep.
From Stars comes this take on a quasi-comedy gore-fest film series in which humanity's only hope against the deadites is shredded breakfast potatoes.
Hash versus Evil Dead.
That is correct. And that means, folks, we have a tie here at the end of regulation.
So exciting!
Meredith, you could take a seat. Tara, Sarah, get ready for our last question. First person to shout out the answer takes today's game. Are you ready, Tara? Oh.
Yes.
Are you ready, Sarah?
Yes.
Here we go.
Good luck.
Bernen Bohen und Spektrum Originals is rebooting this 90s sitcom about Paul and Jamie Kokovan.
Fuck.
Two examples of the food type here. Bernen Bohen und Speck is one. Kokovan is the other. I'm about to call this. No winners today if I do.
I mean, okay, I know the show, but I don't know the food.
Yeah, it seems like you both know the show, so somebody say it.
Yeah. Okay, the show is Mad About You.
Mm-hmm. Burning Bohan and
Speck. Mad About Hen? I have no idea.
Two examples of stew. Mad About
Stew.
Stew.
What? God damn it.
That means we have absolutely no winners. So the winner today is...
Dave.
Me. I'm giving myself a point in this season. So the season stands are now Sarah 3, Value Guest 2, Tara 1, and Dave tied at 1. How very exciting for everybody involved.
Much deserved.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We got our papers in order for Freeform's reimagining of Party of Five before going around the dial with stops at Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, Grand Designs, and Cheer. Meredith cracked the case of the missing canon entry for Murder, She Wrote, we crown winners and losers of the week, and absolutely nobody was okay. The winner of this week's TV dinner game time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Stu,
Sarah D. Bunting,
that question gets no trout,
and Meredith Smith.
Hashtag Fletcher face.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
You know how much I love letters.
Well, yeah, and you're going to enjoy this magazine, Miss Fletcher, especially the article about cisterns.
What the hell? Ah, I still got this.